That's jazz tuba player and composer John Sass with Ripsey's Rumble. It's from his 1997 album, Heavy Tuba and John Sass, in which Sass performs this solo with the group. Sass is a native New Yorker, but he has been living in Vienna since 1989. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. Well, a couple of things that we are going to be updating you on today, and we are continuing with part two of the series we're doing, Prosecuting Egregious Police Crimes When the Law is Out of Order. And in part two today, we'll be taking a look at the case of Laquan McDonald, who, as you know, was killed in a hail of bullets, 16 of them to be exact, fired by police officer Jason Van Dyke, who yesterday was able to make bail. And today, a couple of developments. Mayor Rahm Emanuel has announced just within the hour that he has asked for the resignation of Police Superintendent Gary McCarthy. And Gary McCarthy was the police superintendent who said that the police officer had acted within departmental guidelines. He had said, of course, that the investigation still is ongoing, and he promised a fair and impartial investigation into the killing of Laquan McDonald. The interesting thing, as I said, was that Laquan McDonald was killed more than a year ago. And it has taken this long, and it has taken such extraordinary effort for the system to do what it should be typically doing, which is pursuing justice. In this series, we'll be taking a look at a couple of cases from a legal perspective, and we have the good fortune of having as our guide through this process attorney at law Alton Maddox Jr., who, in my estimation, is one of the finest legal minds this country has, and certainly the oppressed community that should be looking to him for great guidance in these matters, insofar as he has litigated several cases in the city of New York, many of them very high-profile cases, in which he enjoys the unique record, precedent-setting records in some cases, of getting convictions, successfully getting convictions, but not following typical legal strategy. And his record has been very, very valuable to the community, not just in New York City, but around the country, because he has been able to share that expertise gained over well over 40 years in the matter of dealing with these special kinds of cases involving police use of force, and particularly police use of lethal force. And I'm delighted that he joins us again today. Thank you, Alton, for being with us again today.
Again, Eutrice, thanks for the invitation and the warm introduction.
Well, well-deserved, I would say. Very well-deserved. I have covered your cases for well over 30 years, and I know your work. And I continue to say the community is, in my view, quite remiss in not embracing the strides you had made in scoring legal victory after legal victory in this field and literally inventing legal strategies that have to this day still stunned the bureaucracy. And I'm considering ourselves today, again, very, very lucky to have you with us. We are talking today about the Laquan McDonald case, a case in which police officer Jason Van Dyke, who had a record of many run-ins that were typically well within departmental guidelines in some cases, but were nonetheless typically race-based. We find that many of the complaints involved untoward actions that he took to mostly African-American males. And this particular incident occurring on October the 20th last year was particularly gruesome. We witnessed the tape and we witnessed the public execution of this young man who was said to be in the process of committing a crime. But the tape does not show that, and certainly we can't say that the tape would show everything. But we see what we see, and what we see is a young man at a great enough distance away from police, in fact walking away from a contingent of police, and the bullets start flying, the first literally spinning him around and felling him in the middle of the street, and several other shots following that, including you seeing puffs of smoke, those puffs of smoke representing the bullets piercing his body with incredible speed. Because we're talking today, Alton, about the legal aspect of the case, let's start out with what the lawyer for the police officer has to say. This is how he's explaining how he intends to represent his client, Jason Van Dyke. This is attorney Daniel Herbert explaining to the Chicago Sun-Times how he intends to frame his defense and how the public should interpret this film, this videotape, the dash cam videotape that was blocked successfully for so long and that eventually was ordered released by a judge. Let's listen to what Daniel Herbert, the attorney for police officer Jason Van Dyke, says.
As we all know at this point, the video in this case is due to be released. And when it's going to be released, we don't know, but I've seen the video. And the video is graphic, it's violent, and it's difficult to watch at some points. However, and it's not unlike any other video that would depict somebody being shot to death, but I would just state that viewing the video alone is not enough to conclude that my client acted inappropriately in any way, because the video, there's certain things about the video that it clearly does not capture the events that my client was experiencing at the time, and that's very important. It's a critical issue. The video shows it's a limited video. We don't see necessarily everything that was going on before. Part of the shooting is not captured on the video, as far as my client's actions. Second of all, the video does not have any audio, which is a significant factor. And important also is video, by its nature, it's two-dimensional. So the problems with that is that it creates depth perception. It distorts distances. And distances and depth perception are very significant in this case. And I think critically, the most important problem with the video, even if it's a clear video, which it is relatively clear compared to some other ones that I've seen, an important distinction is that the video does not depict what my client was seeing at the time. It is not a video from the eyes of my client. And that's an important distinction here, because the actions of my client are going to be viewed based upon what he was thinking at the time. And I think that the question is not, in this case, whether or not my client was scared when he shot, whether he was in fear for his safety or the safety of others. That's not going to be the question, because that's not going to be in dispute. The question is going to be, would a reasonable police officer in the same situation be scared for himself and for his partners? Because that is a standard that that must be viewed in this case. The United States Supreme Court has talked about the use of force by police officers, and this is their language, it's not ours. They discuss the rationale and the analysis of shootings, and they indicate that police officers are often forced to make split-second decisions, and that their decisions are not to be viewed with the benefit of hindsight and 20/20 vision. Rather, their actions have to be viewed based upon what that officer was experiencing at the time. And we're pretty confident that, after seeing the evidence, which we have not seen all the evidence yet, but and after critically speaking with my client, we're confident that despite the graphic nature of the video, we're confident that my client's actions were not only lawful, but also within department policy and within his training. So we just we ask that everyone please refrain from prejudging this incident solely on the video alone, because the video alone is not enough to conclude that the actions were unlawful or excessive in any manner.
So why then did none of his fellow officers fire any shots that hit Laquan? All of the shots came from your client's gun.
True, and I can't speak for the other officers, but I've done this for a long time, and I do have a lot of training in the area of use of force, and there's many reasons to explain that. Depending upon the officer's perspective, that is the critical issue to whether or not to use force and how much force to use. If somebody has a good amount of distance from the subject, if somebody has shielding, if somebody has an opportunity to retreat, those are all factors that might force an officer or have an officer decide not to fire. We can just say that I'm not sure. There's also the issue of crossfire, but I can't speak to why the other officers didn't shoot, but I certainly can speak to why my client shot, and it is because he believed in his heart of hearts that he was in fear for his life, and he was concerned about the lives of police officers and anyone else that might have been on the scene.
All right. That was the attorney representing police officer Jason Van Dyke, who had fired 16 bullets into the body of Laquan McDonald, 17 years old, on October the 20th last year, explaining that this is really, and this is a really important question, Alton. We definitely get from his attorney that this is not so much a matter of a murder charge, according to the criminal code, but this is a matter of whether the police officer operated within departmental guidelines and within the framework of his professional training. Now, this is where we have come to this juncture all the time when these cases pop up. And we seem to be always arguing, we always dealing with the crossing of the lines between these two schools of thought. So which prevails? Would his attorney, Daniel Herbert, as he's arguing here, and he's putting forward the theory of his case essentially, is that this is not so much a criminal matter as it is a departmental and procedural matter. What do you say? What did you hear from that tape?
Well, what I say is this, Utrice, and I want everybody in the audience to listen very carefully and to write down what I say and to mean it as you go about your daily life, because nothing can be more truer than what I'm getting ready to say. This is why you must have a competent and zealous attorney at the forefront of any litigation, particularly any litigation which is actually a class action. The problem that our people have and we run into is that we don't know enough legalese. And because we don't know enough legalese, we are constantly finding ourselves going from one funeral to the other when some of these things could be stopped. The real question becomes, how do you put Van Dyke behind bars? And that's what I've always been involved in with any case I've ever involved in of this type, because there's a difference between a class action and a personal injury action. A personal injury action involves cases like a rear ender, involves cases like a T-bone, front end, a crash. That's a personal injury action. However, on the other hand, a class action is a case like Laquan McDonald. It is like the case of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. It is like the case of Walter Scott in South Carolina. Because a class action deal with a large body of people, and the issue is the same as it relates to each individual. Even though most of them were not victims then, they may have been targets, but they were not victims. But in any event, it is a class action. This is the case in Chicago, Illinois, a class action. Now, most attorneys do not want to get involved with a class action because they find that it may be too cumbersome to litigate, and they find out that the economic rewards may not be as they would love them to be. And the thing that I learned about the hatred of a class action was when I was working as a poverty lawyer in Harlem, and the U.S. Senate said that we could not, as poverty lawyers, initiate any class actions. So if you went into one of these poverty law offices and you had a problem and the lawyer looked at it and said, well, you know, this sounds like a class action. Well, the lawyer couldn't initiate a class action. He could only litigate a personal action. And so that meant that nothing ever changes because the only change that can come forth is in a class action. Now, as it relates to a case like this, the first question becomes one of how do you define yourself as a lawyer? Do you define yourself simply as an attorney? Or thanks to you, Utrice, do you define yourself as a people's attorney general? I chose to define myself and not to be defined by others. And so with your help making me sound as though I wasn't so egotistical, you gave me the label, and I would have to do it for myself, of telling our community who I really was. And so I want to be thankful to you for that, because otherwise people would have said, well, he's very egotistical. He's always bragging on himself. Well, sometimes you have to brag on yourself, because sometimes our people are so slow, they don't get it. But fortunately, there was somebody around like you who could properly identify me as who I really was. Now, in that sense, this is the issue that relates to this particular attorney. And the argument is simply this. While this attorney may exercise his right of free speech and outside of a courtroom may argue to the public that his client is not guilty for a variety of reasons, this attorney cannot go into a courthouse and before a jury and make that same argument. And the way that you stop that is to file a motion in limine in advance of the trial and require the court to prevent the attorney from making certain arguments to the jury in the first place. That argument is among those that should not be made to any jury. And if there's anybody in Chicago listening now, they should begin to start looking for a competent attorney who has the guts to make a motion to intervene, and then afterwards to make a motion in limine to prohibit this type of garbage to present it to a jury.
Nonetheless, it seems as if both sides would inevitably lock horns on this very dichotomy. Is it about police departmental guidelines, or is it about the police officer's duty to basically not commit a criminal act of homicide? So,
well,
what I'm trying to say is, where, when does, you explained how it could change by having a class action and intervention on basis of class action, but is this not going to be, in effect, where this case is going to go? And both sides would be arguing, but arguing about the wrong thing.
Well, the answer to that is this. This case really hinges on the Eighth Amendment, which prohibits cruel and unusual punishment. And the last time I checked, the only state in the United States that permitted a firing squad was the state of Utah. But in doing a firing squad in Utah, there was only one gunman in the firing squad who had a loaded bullet, and the others did not. And so although there may have been several pellets that may have targeted the person who would eventually become the victim, it was only that one loaded bullet that caused the damage. You're talking about here one man, not a firing squad, having a gun that allowed him to unload at least 16 live bullets into a person. This is a violation of the Eighth Amendment, and it cannot be permitted as an argument in a court of law.
I still want to ask one last question on this point. This very argument and the dichotomy here, the legal dichotomy, these two fields of thought, the pursuit on the part of the prosecutor for conviction on the basis of criminal statutes, and the defense arguing that the criminal statutes really don't apply here. The attorney has already said it's about the police officer's perception of threat to his life and to fellow officers. It is about his training. He was acting essentially on instinct, professional instinct, based on that training. So he can't be held liable for a willful act of homicide. Now, how does the law make the differentiation or allow this differentiation for police officers and not for civilians?
Well, there are two issues here. One is the Eighth Amendment, again, because I don't care whether you're a police officer or not, you cannot dismiss constitutional principles. The second argument is the argument of Garner versus Tennessee, in which the U.S. Supreme Court itself has held that you can't shoot a fleeing felon. So if this young man was not fleeing and was walking in a very orderly manner towards the police or whoever he may have been walking to, or may have just simply be walking somewhere away from the police, the fact of the matter, he is not a fleeing felon. And so in regards to how you can get around it, you can't, because you got two constitutional provisions, one a Supreme Court ruling and another constitutional principle that you got to get passed. And as I said before, you don't have standing as a lawyer to make unconstitutional arguments. I mean, when a lawyer get ready to do a summation, the lawyer cannot say whatever he or she wants to say, because there have been many cases in which the courts have had to reverse on the ground that some prejudicial statement was made to the jury, or that a statement that was not supported by the record was made to the jury. And so in those cases, the court have reversed. And my point here is making a motion in limine is to prevent that, because the argument that you make to the court is, well, if in fact the court has the authority to erase this conviction because of some prejudicial argument that was made to a jury, this is Exhibit A, and would be exercising futility for the court to allow this lawyer to make this argument, and then afterwards for the court to have to reverse.
Well, in the cases that I have covered and the cases that you have tried, none of the prosecutors has ever taken this line of reasoning as part of their prosecution, as part of the strategy for prosecuting police officers who have killed civilians. Do you expect that this would be the exception?
Well, I think that I think it will be the exception if everybody's lips are sealed and people don't understand legalese. You know, you can waive a judicial error by not saying anything. You know, hearsay can be admitted into evidence even though it is prejudicial, unless someone makes an objection. If nobody makes an objection, the courts are simply say, well, you waived that argument by not raising an objection, and so therefore, while the results may have been different otherwise, in this particular case, the results will not be. And this is why, you know, I say all along that, you know, we have to begin to understand how to really deal with these issues. And when lawyers go to law school and are not taught how to put white people behind bars and are then attracted to hush money as an alternative to putting a white person behind bars, this is the problem that we are now facing throughout the country, because case after case is one in which people receive hush money and nobody being punished. And what we find is that white people are willing to put up hush money to support and sustain white supremacy. This is the philosophical aspect of American jurisprudence, and is one in which white people are well healed to actually finance and to make sure that some cop like the one in the case in Chicago will not be harmed at all because of their philosophy of white supremacy.
I want to ask about the videotape. We heard from Daniel Herbert, the attorney for Jason Van Dyke, the officer who shot and killed Laquan McDonald, how he perceives the videotape and how presumably he intends to use the videotape to shore up his legal argument. What does the videotape prove to you? What essential use will it be? Do you expect the prosecution to use it in the manner that you think?
Well, you know, this is my point again. You know, when you study lawyers, you have to go back to law school. I mean, you have to go back to the very basics, and you have to ask the basic questions, and that is, what are lawyers taught in law school? And what you are taught in law school is that you can use no further more force than what is necessary to stop a person from being a threat. You just simply can't say, well, the person's a threat. He has a small a pen knife in his hand, and therefore I'm entitled to pop off 16 rounds to take him down. Well, no law school ever teaches that. And, you know, and my position is no lawyer should be able to, in a court of law, make that kind of argument. Now, you can make that kind of argument under free speech. You can do what this lawyer has done. But in a court of law, the argument should be different. And because they should be different, we should be having results that are consistent with the teaching that are given to lawyers, you know, and not things that are beyond the scope of that instruction.
Apart from the things that you've raised so far, what if you were prosecuting this case? What would be the issues you think you could nail the police officer on and get a secure conviction? Where do you see the weaknesses in any defense they're likely to put up?
Well, I think the weaknesses in the defenses that they may put up is how well you convince the judge to tailor the jury instructions. And if the judge is tailoring those jury instructions consistent with the laws of Illinois, it would seem as though the jury instructions would have to be in your favor, and you would simply stand behind those jury instructions and explain to the jury why it's important to continue to adhere to those jury instructions, even if it means a conviction of this particular police officer. I think first and foremost, and this is what I suggest to lawyers, the first thing you should do when you get a case is to immediately start researching your instructions to the jury. Unfortunately, most lawyers do the way that we approach a book. They start from the beginning of the book and read to the end, and most very seldom do people start at the end of the book and go back to the beginning. But that should be the real approach in terms of lawyering.
Well, we'll take this break, and when we come back, we continue our discussion about the killing of Laquan McDonald and the legal implications of the case right after this. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead, and our guest is Attorney at War and the People's Attorney General, Alton Maddox. We are deconstructing the beginnings of what is assembling itself to be the trial, presumably of police officer Jason Van Dyke, who on October the 20th last year shot and killed with 16 bullets Laquan McDonald in Chicago. Well, you talked about hush money, and this is going to be an issue as well, a legal issue, because the city of Chicago apparently agreed to pay the family of Laquan McDonald a $5 million payout prior to any charge being levied against the police officer, and certainly prior to any trial of any sort, prior to the conclusion of any investigation. And they seemed to agree that it was in the interest of all to come to terms with the family with this $5 million payout. Here's how Alderman Roderick Sawyer, who's the head of the City Council Black Caucus, here's how he explained this settlement.
You know, the fact that that takes 396 days for this type of indictment, this is, I'm a lawyer, I'm not a criminal lawyer, but I can see this in 5 minutes and tell, hey, this guy's guilty of something. We need to charge him with something.
What?
He should not be on the police report, a police department getting a check. I think, as horrific as the video is, when the Corporation Council informed us that it was a bad shot, a bad shooting, they have videotape of a bad shooting, we need to settle this case quickly. I mean, I'm satisfied, but I'm still horrified that he shot a young man 16 times. We knew that he shot him multiple times, you know, some in the back, you know, but he was not resisting.
What's the case say of the nation about Chicago right now?
Chicago's on the forefront right now. The Chicago is, you know, this tape, you know, is as horrific as it is, I'm hoping it will be a catalyst for some change. You know, it may maybe get people more involved in their communities, more involved in electoral activity, more involved in police and community relations. You know, that's what I'm looking for.
But doesn't it sort of...
Well, that was Alderman Roderick Sawyer explaining why the city of Chicago agreed to come to terms with the family prior to any investigation being concluded in the shooting death of Laquan McDonald. Quite a few things said there, Alton, that are troubling to me. I don't like the idea that the councilman seems to be okay, the alderman seems to be okay with the idea that this should be a point, a death of another death of an African-American young man by police. Lethal use of force should serve as some kind of a coming together. I shudder when I hear these kinds of things because the price is so high, it seems to be. And people should be outraged, and we should never think in terms that a person's death is what we should use as a way of bringing people together. But I want to talk about something he said that would be very critical, it seems to me, in the legal sense. He said that the Corporation Council said it was a bad shot, a bad shooting, and therefore urged, one presumes also with the knowledge and approval of the mayor, urged the $5 million payout. Now, if you were the officer's defense attorney, Daniel Herbert, would this be a wonderful piece of ammunition going into a trial?
Well, it would not be a wonderful piece of ammunition for this reason, Eutrice. The Corp Council, the City of Chicago, do not act independently of a police union. Now, when there was some agreement that hush money should be put out, I can assure you that the real concern was that of Van Dyke and whether this would be seen as some admission of guilt in any way. And when collective heads got together, the conclusion that they came to in the interest of Van Dyke was that $5 million would not in any way harm his legal position at trial. Because otherwise they would have never offer that money, and the union would have never done it because the union has a obligation to represent its members in a very effective fashion. Now, while some may argue that it may be seen as an admission of guilt, I can guarantee you that Van Dyke and the Corp Council and the City of City of Chicago and the City Council of Chicago and all other interested parties did not come to that conclusion, and that they in some way believe, as I believe, and I've seen a lot of these hush money cases, do not work out the way that people think, and that the jurors do not accept this hush money payment as a admission of guilt. On the other hand, what I would suggest to the family, though, is that it would make a motion to undo this settlement, to vacate the settlement, and to return the money to the City of Chicago. I believe that that particular act would make the family look a lot more credible, and I believe that the family should then turn around and restart another lawsuit as a class action, and therefore put other people in the class and proceed with lawyers who are not interested as ambulance chasers in the case, but in terms of lawyers who are really interested in justice. And I think that this would be the most appropriate outcome ultimately for this case, even though I think there are many people that may feel as though hush money in the first instance should be what should be pursued. I'm just not one of them.
But doesn't this $5 million payout, done, you know, under the radar, if you will, doesn't that itself break the law? Because the city arbitrarily has decided, in effect, to just give a family some money. And, of course, the presumption is for them to just not make any further waves. Is this not a way of basically bribing a family and using taxpayer dollars to do it and doing it in a way that you lean on the city council's black caucus to champion this act within the caucus so as to make the mayor look good and to take the heat off the mayor in the same way that the mayor's demand for the resignation of the police chief today takes the heat off of him a little bit and buys some time so that they can regather themselves and, you know, form a new wall of protection, legal protection around them, because, you know, a lot of challenges are going to be on the way. But is this legal?
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head. This is the reality. The city of Chicago actually suppressed evidence that could have been favorable to the family. And so, therefore, you do not have a fair bargain here, which is a requirement of contract law, is that when people bargain, they should be bargaining with all the facts known on the table. And to the extent that you got an agreement through fraud by suppressing evidence, taste the entire agreement. And that's the reason why I said that I would simply, as a family, do a preemptive strike and just simply return that money immediately. And then with the new evidence, proceed as a class action with doing discovery and all of the other things that are essential to a fair trial and move from there. And at the same time, monitor what is happening in the criminal trial.
Still, it's $5 million more, some would say, than they could ever have hoped to have. And better take it now, since it's being offered, than to risk not getting it at all at some point in the future if the legal case should go another way. Certainly, the lawyers who are involved in this case in behalf of the family found it fit to advise a family to enter such an agreement. So what should be the public's reaction here? What should be the reaction of all those people who are in the streets calling for justice? Should they begin to weigh the benefit to the family, the monetary benefit to the family, as against the long-term gamble about whether justice, in fact, will prevail?
No, well, this is what I would do, because I think, as I started to say from the beginning, the first thing you have to have is competent and zealous counsel, people who really understand legalese and the entire legal process. And so the family, in my estimation, will be given an opportunity to initially move to vacate this. But that's not the only card that can be played. And therefore, if the family, for whatever reason, decide they want to stick with hush money, then I think that should be a taxpayer's lawsuit. And the taxpayer argued one way or the other that this is a fraudulent agreement, one in which the city of Chicago, should not be engaged in, and for the taxpayers to move to vacate, and, you know, then afterwards, regardless of what, the family would be left with the choice of whether they want to really proceed in terms of hush money, or whether this should be a real class action. And this is the point that is happening right here, is that the people of Chicago have an excellent opportunity here to really change some law in this area and maybe contribute to eventually bringing in to all this outrageous acts of police brutality that is taking place in this nation. And so, you know, it's like starting lawsuits. It can be a protracted struggle when you, until you ultimately get what you want. But the struggle has to start somewhere, and it will end somewhere. And in the meantime, a lot of this garbage will be cleaned out of the garbage can, and we all begin to breathe some fresh air.
Of late, we're hearing some familiar voices calling again, a little bit too late, it seems to me, for an independent investigation into the killing of Laquan McDonald. And I'm referring to people like the Reverend Al Sharpton and the Reverend Jesse Jackson and others who have appeared on the scene now that momentum has been built by essentially a wide array of grassroots organizations that have been working to build resistance and opposition to this trend of just killing off of young black men and Latino men in our country. So I want to ask about the role here. I played a tape yesterday. I shared a tape of Jesse Jackson and Congressman Bobby Rush talking at the weekend protest, urging people, again, to use their votes strategically, but also calling for, you know, what they want is the resignation of the police superintendent, which the mayor had announced today, not because they called for it, but because it is of strategic value to him to do so. But one, is this call for independent investigation, federal investigation, is it worth it based on the fact that federal investigations themselves are statistically discouraging in terms of yielding the benefit of justice? And number two, is the call too late or is it genuine at all when one considers how close these voices are to the Democratic Party, and these killings inordinately are occurring in urban areas that are heavily Democrat. And at a time when we have a very important presidential race, it seems to me that if the muscle is going to be flexed, here's a great time for these voices to be calling for the absolute and brutal punishment of the Democratic Party for encouraging these killings by their inaction and by clearly their corruption and collusion to protect these police officers and the police system.
Well, you know, the answer to that is this, Eutrice, and this is something that people have to recognize. And it's been said in so many different ways, and we have to respect it, and that is the importance of history itself. I don't speak in terms of what I may personally feel, because what I personally feel is not important. But what I do as a historian, because that's one of the things you have to do in terms of the practice of law, of course, many lawyers don't find the need to document history, and I'm one of those who find the need to document history. Unfortunately, I don't have all of the resources that are necessary to appropriately document history. But, you know, I do nonetheless make some journal entries as it reflects to history, you know, as I do make journal entries as it reflects to people who may support me, you know, in terms of what I do. You know, and so in that regard, what we have to understand about Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton is that they birthed the civil rights, SILVERRIPES movement. Now, this movement started a little bit earlier than 1990. But in 1990, I became a witness of it, and this is where it really flowed. This movement is a very dangerous movement, and it has been very beneficial to Jesse Jackson, and it's been very beneficial to Al Sharpton, and it has been very detrimental to the rest of the black community. And that is in making sure that black people always knocking on the wrong door, talking to the wrong people, and asking the wrong questions. This is a form of misdirection, and it's the activities of Judas Goetz. And these two men qualify appropriately as Judas Goetz, and their job and mission always on behalf of the slave master is to send us in the wrong direction. And so the only reason I may listen to what Charbonneau Jackson said just to confirm what I know about them, but I certainly would not in any way be listening to either one of these men for any advice or information or direction. And so in the sense of Chicago, they have a real serious interest in it. And, you know, I know that I opened up a can of worms that I would like to really be able to close. I don't know whether I'm going to have enough time today or not, but I hope that you will call me back as quickly as possible so that I can really nail down the
call. We do have tomorrow. We do have another case to look at.
Well, you got tomorrow, because I really want to go into what this is really all about. You know, and we have to understand, and I'm not talking about opinions. I'm talking about fact. I'm talking about history. You know, I'm talking about those things that really back up what people are about. And this is a real critical point for our people to begin to understand this, because we're not going to get another shot. As you said, the highlight of all of this is the Democratic Party and Hillary Clinton. And if we don't get it right between here and 2017, we're going to be dead as ducks on a beach. I mean, that's just the only way that you can phrase it. I mean, that's where we're headed. We're not going to get any more second chances. This is it for us. Now, we can either put cotton in our ears and refuse to listen, or whatever we may decide to do, but there will be no second chance. I can assure you of that.
As we close the program today, what should we expect? Based on your history of prosecuting these cases and litigating, not prosecuting, but litigating these cases, what do you expect would be the legal turns this case will take?
Well, not guilty. I mean, I can say that most assuredly. As it presently is situated, and unless we come to our senses, this will be another case of a police officer walking. I can assure you that, as I am assuring you now, that we're not going to be alone for this earth after 2017.
I want to thank you very much, Alton, for being with us today and for giving us some insights into the legal backgrounds of this case. And, you know, it's really important because the news coverage doesn't really allow us to appreciate what is happening, what the machinations are behind, you know, closed doors, behind that curtain, that legal curtain that descends, and everybody now talks about a trial, but they don't understand some, for the most part, they don't understand the nitty-gritty of the legal aspects of these kinds of cases.
You're absolutely right. I just seem like to end up with this real quick. You know, when I met you, it was in Brooklyn. We were doing Howard Beach. And now I have to talk to you in cyberspace. And I think the lesson to be learned there is that you and what you are trying to do for our community has made you a media refugee. And it's going to get worse than that if we don't put our thinking caps on and turn this thing around.
Thanks again, Alton, for being with us today. I really appreciate it. We have the Tamir Rice case coming up tomorrow. And that brings us to the end of our program today. I hope some of these issues that were sounded out begin to make you think a bit differently about these cases. This is not just, you know, the pro forma legal cases. These are cases that have a very peculiar history to them and a predestined outcome to them. And in the middle are the people affected by them, and the question as to which direction do the people choose to go. This is the issue. What do we choose to do? How do we choose to challenge the system and basically design a system of our own that allows us literally to survive? This is a big, big issue for us. I want to thank you so much for joining me today. As always, a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. Keep it right here on PRN.FM, your favorite station, and tell people about this program and the station. Coming up next, Infectious Myth with David Crowe. And you can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. Let me know how these programs are resonating with you. As always, a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. See you tomorrow.